Welcome to the Grace Fellowship Church of Ephrata podcast. Our desire is to help you grow in your journey with Jesus, no matter where you are. For more information, please check out our website at www.gfchurch.net.
And we have actually been spending some time through the book of Esther. Today is that last week of Esther. We're going to wrap everything up and conclude. We've seen a lot of different things about this book that may be borderline controversial, might be new to some of you. I did have somebody say something to me in the back once, wow, I didn't know this book was that controversial. Well, it is. It is. There is some stuff in it. Even as much as why is it included in the biblical canon, there are people that argue about this. So anyway, we want to get into today and wrap up Esther and see what God has for us this morning. Now, I think all of us have heard or read or seen maybe on a screen a story that maybe we would call them a whoa story, or there was a whoa moment as we were reading it or seeing it or whatever it was, something that when you came across it gave the whole story brand new life. As I've told you all, I'm trying to make up for lost time with some of the reading that I never did before, so I'm trying to read through a lot of the classic books that they have on all these lists, and a couple of them, and I'm going to say the first one just so you know, I am secure enough in my manliness to admit that I read this, and I know some of you know I read this, Kelly Barr does, I know, and that is Pride and Prejudice, because I'm a man, because I am not at all intimidated to read Jane Austen, Pride and Prejudice, or To Kill a Mockingbird, another one I read in The Great Gatsby. All three of these have something interesting in them. They have a whoa moment that the lights turn on, and all of this laborious reading that you've been having throughout the majority of the book, something changes your entire perspective about the entire thing. With Pride and Prejudice, Mr. Darcy is seen as this, you know, rich guy who doesn't care about people, and he's too uppity to really deal with people. And then you see towards the end, by the way, spoilers coming. If you haven't read it, you've had a couple hundred years. But there's this turning point where all of a sudden you see Mr. Darcy has been doing this stuff for the Bennet family because of his love for their daughter. And it's like, what? You know, crazy moment. To Kill a Mockingbird, Boo Radley ends up becoming a hero in the story, whereas everyone thought he was a monster. And then The Great Gatsby, you have this guy who's throwing these elaborate parties in the 1920s and wealth and all of this, and come to find out he's a guy who just has a crush on somebody and he's been trying to impress her. He's not really as wealthy as he has given the appearance of. We've seen it in movies. M. Night Shyamalan had two with Sixth Sense and The Village that were all these whoa moments that totally changed your perspective. And you could even say that even in Scripture, you have the prodigal son that we talked about 2 years ago, that maybe the prodigal son is the wrong title for the story, because the main character of the story is actually the self-righteous brother, not the one that runs off. That's what we know and we talk about and so on, but the point of it is the self-righteous brother that doesn't rejoice when his brother comes back. These are woe moments. These are things that once you find them out, you're like, well, I got to go back and watch this movie again, or I got to go reread this book, because this totally changes your original perspective on the story. Esther, I could say, is one of those, because there is some debate as to who the main person is in this book. There are some that say Esther. Well, that's easy. The book's called Esther, and you see her rise to power, and she liberates the Jewish people and all this. There's some, though, that would say it's actually Mordecai. Because Mordecai, Esther wouldn't have been prompted to even do that if it wasn't for Mordecai. And even in the last few chapters of this book, Esther kind of takes a back seat and Mordecai becomes the main character in the remainder of the story. But there's a third perspective, my perspective. And this sounds so Sunday school, okay? And that is, it's God. Because God's not mentioned in this book, and yet you see his fingerprints everywhere and how things went down. So today we are going to wrap up the story, and I've done this the last couple weeks. I've sort of intentionally not just read, okay, chapters 1 and 2, chapters 3 and 4, chapters and so on. I've been hopping back from time to time to cover something else, and we're going to do that today because, yes, we are going to talk about the last few chapters, but I want us to jump back. Last week, if you tuned in to this station, you will remember that we left it right as Esther reveals to King Xerxes that her people are about to be murdered, and the one behind it is having dinner with them. And that is Haman. And that is where we cut it. Before we continue the story, I want to hop back to an event that happened before that, because remember the perspective that God is in this story all throughout it. All throughout it. And sometimes in ways we never imagined would happen. If you look back at Esther chapter 6, and we're going to start at verses 1 to 3. I'll have it up here on the screens, and as well as if you want to look it up in your own device or Bible. Esther chapter 6, verses 1 to 3 starts this way. On that night, this is after the first feast that Esther throws for them. Remember, there were two. On that night, the king could not sleep. They must have had caffeine or something for dinner at Esther's first one. It's a joke. You can have a good time at church, people. It's okay. Laugh. Be joyful. Okay? He can't sleep. The king cannot sleep. And he gave orders to bring the book of memorable deeds, the Chronicles, and they were read before the king. I say this to my shame. I was a camp counselor at River Valley Ranch for many years. I had 7 and 8 year old boys. When they were all sugared up and could not sleep, one of my practices was to have them all lay in bed and I would begin to read the book of Leviticus to them. Parents, that's a hack. You can take that and use that. They were out. And that's basically what the king's doing. He's like, bring the most boring possible thing that you can to put me to sleep. And so they bring up the Chronicles of the king, all the business meeting notes, all of the decisions that were made. And this individual begins to read to it. It says in verse 2, and it was found written how Mordecai had told about Bigthana and Teresh. We saw that back in chapter 1. Two of the king's eunuchs who guarded his bedroom, the threshold, and who had sought to lay hands on King Ahasuerus or King Xerxes. So all of a sudden, 5 years later, something that happened 5 years later when Mordecai heard these two assistants to the king, he's reminded of this. Oh, yeah, there's this guy Mordecai. I totally forgot about him, and he did not get any reward for saving my life, literally. So, we have this going on. It says, who guarded the threshold. Okay, verse 3. And the king said, what honor and distinction has been bestowed on Mordecai for this? The king's young men who attended him said, nothing's been done for him. And if you skip down to verse 6, it says, so Haman comes in. Basically this, the king's like, we never rewarded this guy. It's been 5 years. We got to reward him. He saved my life. Man, this is embarrassing. And so they come up with their idea of what they're going to do. And he says, you know what? Let me call in Haman. I'm going to have him give some input to this. So they bring in Haman to get his advice. It says, so Haman comes in, and the king said to him, what should be done to the man who the king delights to honor? And Haman said to himself, this is Haman inside his brain, whom would the king delight to honor more than me? Oh, man, let me tell you, I got it all going. He's going to reward me because obviously who else would he talk about? I mean, come on. He wants to honor me. It's going to be Haman Day tomorrow. We're going to have a holiday feast. It's going to be amazing. Fireworks. It's great. So Haman begins to say, well, here's what all should be done for a person that delights in the king. And he starts to think, what would I really like? And so he begins to list all of these things off to King Xerxes. And down in verse 10, then the king says to Haman, hurry, take the robes and the horse that you said, the royal robes, real fancy robes and the horse that you have said, and do so to Mordecai the Jew, who sits at the king's gate. leave out absolutely nothing that you have mentioned. So here, Haman is thinking, man, I'm going to have the greatest celebration in my honor, because that's obviously what the king's talking about, only for it to completely reverse. And the king's like, oh, yeah, hey, great, sounds awesome. Go do it to Mordecai. And you can imagine how he would have felt about this. And it goes on and it says that he does all of this, and it only makes him angrier and more determined to kill Mordecai. Well, let's fast forward then, because we now move to Esther and the second meal that she has. Last week, we had it where she reveals that Haman was the one trying to kill her people. And in chapter 7, verses 8 and 9, it says this: "And the king returned from the palace garden to the place where they were drinking wine, as Haman was falling on the couch where Esther was. And the king said, 'Will he even assault the queen in my presence in my house?' As the word left the mouth of the king, they covered Haman's face." So here's what happens. If you've never heard the story before, bear with me if you have. She reveals Haman's the one who's trying to kill us, my people, all of us. And it says that the king storms out of the room. Now Haman is mortified. Remember, he did not even know she was Jewish. And as a result, he now is begging her for mercy. He throws himself on her couch where she would have been sitting or reclining. He throws himself on the couch. Let me tell you why this is controversial. Number one, it's the king's wife. Number two, there was a rule in place that members of the harem, of which she was, no man was allowed to be alone with a member of the harem, ever. Doesn't matter. And if you were to even address a member of the harem, you had to be at least 7 feet away from her. You could not be, hey, you know, if you're a close talker, you're in trouble. You don't do close talking with a member of the harem, or you're not going to have a face anymore. Anyway, you get the picture with this. And here he is throwing himself, begging her for mercy while the king's out. Think about this. What options did he have in that moment? Where else could he have gone? If he goes out to the king's ticked off. If he leaves the room, because he should have, then it makes him look guilty. And so he did the only option he knew, and that is to beg her, somehow don't let what's about to happen happen. And it says the king walks in, sees this, he's like, you're hitting on my wife? In my palace, you're hitting on my wife? Okay, there's a problem with that. It says that his face was covered, which implies that guards threw a bag or something over his head, which is normally not a good sign if that happens to you. If that happens to you often, please come talk to me, because I really need to help you. Verse 9 then says, "Then Harbona, one of the eunuchs in attendance on the king, said, 'Moreover, the gallows that Haman has prepared for Mordecai, whose word saved the king, is standing at Haman's house, 50 cubits high.' And the king said, 'Hang him on it.'" Now, if you go back to week one about this discussion, this is the way that the ESV has talked about this. It mentions the gallows, you know, and you think of the Old West and being hung and all this stuff, or, you know, even the French Revolution, early America, so on. The better interpretation, if you remember, is that it was an impalement pole, because this was the common way of killing people back then, was you have a big spike in the ground and you put them on it and they get the point. So, making sure you're paying attention, okay. Haman had constructed one 50 cubits high, and you're like, I don't know how much a cubit is. It's roughly, this was 75 feet high. He had constructed this because he wanted everybody to see Mordecai dead. You would see him from a distance, this body on this spike. And so he constructed this to make just a mockery of Mordecai's life. And now the king says, he created it for Mordecai. Now it will be used on him. Wow. What a turn of events. What a cold dish of irony. You see, Haman had a lot of great ideas, and he had a lot of things that he tried to do. And you see, starting with the king having a night of insomnia, everything starts to switch. And everything that this guy had planned, thought, tried, the main character of the story, God, turns on its head just because of a night of insomnia. The story goes on, and if you skip to chapter 8, looking at verse 2, I'll come back. Actually, you know what? Let me get to that story. I forgot the one picture I have in there. This is irony here, and this is one of my, you know, crazy stories I come across just to show you irony. This past week, I read about Sigurd the Mighty. He was a Viking ruler. He was known to be savage and horrible, and he had an enemy named Mael, M-A-E-L. He decided to set up his enemy for a battle. And him being cruel and uncaring, he told Mael to bring 40 of his troops while he brought 80 of his. And it was a slaughter, complete slaughter. And he beheads Mael, which, by the way, Mael was known for having teeth that he probably needed a dentist, okay? He hung Mael's head on his horse while he rode back home after he had been cruel and savage to this man. And you would think, what an awful person. He needs judgment. Well, he got it. Because one of the teeth of Mael cut his leg. And over the next few days, he did nothing about it. It began to grow infected, it became septic, and he died. And you could say that Sigurd, who killed somebody, was killed by the person he killed. There was irony in this. And you can see this exact same thing with Haman, where it backfires. All of his evil plans backfired because God was in control. And then going to chapter 8, verse 2 said this, the king, after Haman is dead, the king takes off his signet ring, which was a sign of authority, which he had taken from Haman, now that Haman is dead, and he gives it to Mordecai. And Esther set Mordecai over the house of Haman. If you recall, I said Haman was the second in command. The king had made him basically his vice president. And now, another twist of irony, now Mordecai is second in command. You go from being somebody who is about to be killed to the second in control of this kingdom. Wow. Wow. Haman is dead. Mordecai takes his throne. Queen Esther gives it to him. And then in verse 10 and 11 in chapter 8, it says this, and he wrote in the name of King Ahasuerus, this is Mordecai writing this, and sealed it with the king's signet ring, which gives it authority. Then he sent the letters by mounted couriers riding on swift horses that were used in the king's service, bred from the royal stud. These were the best horses of all the horses. Verse 11, saying, the king allowed the Jews who were in every city to gather and defend their lives. Now, why on earth would that be what he would rule? Why would he say the Jews can't die anymore? Well, the reason is the king could not go back on his word. This was the law. And he had already said they can be wiped out, killed, murdered. Since he could not go back on his word, he said, Mordecai, you do what you think is best. And Mordecai's like, okay, we're going to give permission for them to defend themselves. And anyone that threatens them, who thought to destroy or kill or annihilate any armed forces of any people or province that might attack them. And now the uncomfortable part, children and women included, and to plunder their goods. I don't know if you remember a couple weeks ago, but I had mentioned the Agagite part of Haman. He was a part of the Agagite, which back in 1 Samuel 15, King Saul did not eliminate a people group like God told him to, which included women and children. He was to totally wipe them out, the Amalekites, and he didn't. And we see that now hundreds of years later, 500 years later, one of those remaining survivors of the Amalekites causes all this problem. And now you see Mordecai saying, we're going to rectify this. Anyone who tries to kill the Jews, we're wiping them all out. They had a right to defend, and Mordecai did this. And Mordecai, you begin to see now take the limelight of this story. The Jews over one day kill 75,000 people that threatened them. This makes us a little uncomfortable because this is basically a holy war. but it is ordained to protect the Jewish people. It's one of those other uncomfortable things about this story, that God would even allow this to go on. But it was to defend the Jewish people that they could fight to defend themselves. Basically, you could say they did what King Saul didn't do 500 years earlier. And then going into chapter 9, the story begins to resolve itself. It says, "Now in the 12th month, which is the month of Adar, on the 13th day of the same, when the king's command and edict were about to be carried out, on the very day when the enemies of the Jews hoped to gain mastery over them, the reverse occurred." In the Hebrew, I love it. It basically is the same phrase for "the tables have been turned." Everything was reversed, and the Jews gained mastery over those who hated them. They better have mastery. They just knocked out 75,000 of them. Reversals are a common theme in this book. Over and over again, I mean, I've highlighted some of them. You have reversal after reversal. If you want to go back through the book of Esther on your own, look at everything that starts one way and ends the complete opposite. Some of the reversals that you see in this book are things such as, finding my place here real quick. The genocidal plan was switched to a protected status. You see Mordecai is victim, and he gets turned into the second in command. You see Haman honored by Xerxes to being impaled by Xerxes. You see the impalement pole he had made for Mordecai being used on Haman and eventually his 10 sons. Reverse, 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 reverse. God was in this. He may not have been mentioned, but God was in this. And even in small ways, but obviously in large ways. And a day was, a holiday was started at this point. Down in verse 26, it says this. "Therefore, they called these days," 2 days, to recognize when the Jews were able to protect themselves, "after the term pure." This word pure, just so you know, has two meanings to it. Dice and destiny. Dice. That kind of rings a bell. Where was dice in this story? Who used dice? Anyone remember? Or did I do a lousy job pointing that out? I did a lousy job pointing that out. Haman. If you remember about 2 weeks ago, Haman said, "When am I going to eliminate the Jews?" And he rolled a dice, and it was 11 months. He said, "Yes, I'm going to eliminate them." The word pure reminds you of dice, but it also is used for destiny. And the Jewish people would often say of this holiday, Purim, which is every March, God's people's destiny will not be determined by Haman's dice. It was a reminder that Haman thought he had it. Oh, he thought he had it. You don't determine that. God determines that. The main character of our story. Our point today is this. God speaks in the mundane and the miraculous. God speaks. God spoke in this story from the get-go. How he allowed Esther, even if it was against her will, to be put into the position she was put into. God speaks when Haman had evil intents and God reversed them. God speaks when a king can't sleep one night. God spoke through the mundane things of life and the miraculous things of life. And God will do the same for you. And God does the same for you. He works in the miraculous and he works in the mundane. Some of you have had personal miracles in your life. Whether it was a diagnosis that was reversed or things that should never have happened. You can point out the miraculous, but can you also point out the mundane things that God brings into your life that begins to lead to greater things happening? Sometimes the mundane is just as important as the miraculous. God spoke in Esther through dice, insomnia, a messy romance, an impalement pole, and a festering sin 500 years in the making. God's promises prevailed through it all. He is in control. He is in control of your life. Even the messy and the not so great, he is in control because you're a part of his story. And that's really what we must keep in perspective, is our life is but a small piece of the greater story of God. And when we come to that understanding, it's like one of those whoa moments, like I said at the beginning, when you have this realization that even the mundane things going on in your life are a part of God's bigger story. You may be going through a difficult time. It's a part of God's story. You may be going through a time of success. It's a part of God's story. All of these things point to Him. So I give you two takeaways, things to put into practice, things to dwell on this week. Number one, God uses common people as much as the visible. Where is that coming from, Dan? Esther was just a Jewish girl that God took and put into a position. Mordecai, yeah, he was in a council, but he was overlooked often. They were not priests. They were not spiritual giants that we know of, and yet God chose to use common people to do what could only be done through them. It was God's purposes for their life. They were put into extraordinary circumstances, and God used them in a mighty way. Do not think this morning that because, well, I'm not a pastor, I'm not a deacon, I'm not a missionary, I'm not in full-time service, that God cannot use you. Some of the greats of the faith were led to Jesus by common people. Be them Sunday school teachers, be them small group leaders, be them people that led a Youth for Christ thing. My father came to Christ through Youth for Christ. All of these common people are needed as much as the visible ones. So don't think you can't have an impact on the direction of Christianity in our country. You better believe you can. Because God likes to take the small and the insignificant and do amazing things through them. Don't discount yourself. And secondly, remember, God's works often and overtly. I talk about this a lot because it's a practice I have in my life. Remember when God answers a prayer request, gives you a success, does something awesome through your life, and it impacts the lives of others and so on. Remember it frequently. Write it down. Do something to remind yourself of it. Make sure that it is visible, that you celebrate it often, that you take it as a moment to reflect, and that you also put your hope that God is not done with you yet. I have this picture in my office. I may have pointed this out before. And you may come in sometime and see this and be like, why does Dan have a janitorial closet picture in his office? This was my time at Liberty when I was in charge of the entire cleaning crew of Liberty University. This was a very humbling time for me. God was chiseling away stuff in my life, and I didn't like it one bit. But I leave this because what God was able to lead me into and use me to do after this moment, this was the turning point for me. This is when the tables were turned. When things that seemed unfortunate and awful and ugly and bad, God said, let me show you who's in charge. And He allowed me to continue to serve Him in the ministry, and I still get to be a part of that. I have this up as my reminder that when I see it, it's not like whatever, it's a picture of a janitorial closet, that I take the time to reflect, what has God done since this moment? What has He been able to do in my life through this moment? You need those of yourself. I don't care if it is a thankfulness jar that you have in your house that you put drops of paper in with what you're grateful for. I don't care if it is a wall. Literally, I had somebody take this very, very real. They did this isn't a picture of it. This is just an idea of it. But they had a gratefulness wall in their house. They let their children write on the wall. Why not let them, get the opportunity to do that since they do it anyway? But they would write what they were thankful for, how God had answered prayer on this wall, because guess what? You can paint over it anyway. But the point was this. We want it to be visible. We want to reflect upon it. We want to keep it going. How has God answered prayer? What has God done? Maybe that's what you do. College students, don't do that. because you're going to get fined. You can put paper up and do it. A special day. If there's a special day that you need to remember what God has done, highlight it on your calendars. Celebrate it. Reflect on it. Think about what God has done and what he's going to continue to do. And maybe it's just a location where God did something significant in your life. Answer to prayer that you will intentionally go to. Whatever the case, remember God's works in your life often and overtly, because if you do not, they will just become common. And my God is not a God of just common. He's a God of the extraordinary and what he can do. Esther is a story about God moving even when they may not have seen it. He was setting things in place. Even when they didn't necessarily hear from him, we have no account of God speaking in this book. Or maybe they didn't even feel it, because Mordecai was pretty terrified there, thinking they were all going to die. But God was on the move, and he's in the move in your life. And for some of you, you need to take time to reflect on that. One, you've not been disqualified to be used by him. Two, how is he using the mundane and the miraculous in your life for his purposes? I hope in the future, when we get to glory one day, and I am in heaven, that I have time to look back at the history of our world, and even some of the most awful times in our human history, look back and say, now I see what God was doing there. Now it makes sense. Because it's all about him and what he's going to do in your life. Let's pray. Father, as we come to prayer this morning, I want to pray for those that maybe need a reminder that you are in charge. It has been difficult and hard and not a pleasant time in our life. Father, I ask that you would help us to get a glimpse of what you are doing in our story. Lord, that you would awaken us, that even the mundane things such as a night of insomnia for King Xerxes that you used to bring about bigger things, that you used for your glory. And Lord, I don't know if it's just that there's something small that even happens tomorrow. Help us to see how you are working in our life. Lord, that you are going to bring your glory through it all. Lord, if there's anyone here who thinks that they've been disqualified, that you can't use them, I ask that they would leave here encouraged and open to what you may choose to do through them here and in the lives of many. God, that you would give them open doors of ministry with people that they're standing in line with, the people that they're working with, people that are their roommates or whatever it is. God, that you would give them those open doors to be used by you like Esther was, like Mordecai was, and that they would take confidence that you are working. You are working. Lord, we love you and we can't wait to see what you are going to do through this church as we choose to be courageous like Esther. And we ask this in your name. Amen.
Well, that's it for this week. Thank you for joining us. If you would like prayer, you can send your prayer request into prayer@gfchurch.net and we will pray for you. If you like this message, don't forget to subscribe on the podcast app, Google or Spotify. Give us a follow on Facebook and Instagram. We look forward to seeing you next week.